This is Ken Jones, host of Jonesy. On today's show, we celebrate the life of Susan DeFreitas, who passed away 2 weeks ago at her home in Santa Fe at the way too young age of 47. Susan was a much-loved member of the Portland writing community, all of us here who felt blessed to know her are heartbroken. Susan was an author, poet, artist, storyteller, and a master book coach, one of the very best. You only need to ask the many writers she inspired and guided to publication. She was dedicated to telling stories that are socially engaged, stories that matter, and helping others do the same. Her novel Hot Season won a Gold Ippy Award for Best Fiction of the Mountain West, and she was named one of 25 Oregon authors every Oregonian must read, alongside writers like Cheryl Stray, Chuck Palahniuk, Willie Vlaughton, and Ursula Le Guin. Speaking of Ursula, Susan's next book was Dispatches from Anaris, Tales in Tribute to Ursula K. Le Guin from Portland's Forest Avenue Press. Susan edited this collection of stories inspired by Le Guin's life and work, with contributions from many of the Pacific Northwest's top writers. I had the joy of speaking with Susan about Dispatches from Anaris in December 2021, shortly after the book's released. We were joined by David Naiman, who wrote the book's foreword and co-authored his own tribute to Ursula, the book Ursula K. Le Guin, Conversations on Writing. We'll be playing that episode of Jonesy for you today in Susan's memory. Susan is survived by her husband Daniel Timmons and son Calder, who was born in August 2023. The family set up a fundraiser to help with funeral and medical expenses, child care, and a college fund for Calder. If you'd like to contribute, you can do that online at GoFundMe.com. Just search for Calder Timmons. Before we get started, a reminder that KABU is in the middle of our annual All Thrills, No Frills special programming campaign going on now through April 15th. You can check out our full list of specials and marathons at kabu.fm/ATNF4. Now here, from December 2021, our conversation with Susan DeFreitas and David Naiman. Good morning and welcome to Jonesy, the show that brings you conversations with some of the most interesting people in the world of books, podcasts, radio, theater, music, and humor, guaranteed to entertain and enlighten. I'm the host of Jonesy, Ken Jones, no relation by the way. On today's show, we pay tribute to perhaps Oregon's greatest writer, Ursula K. Le Guin. I'm sure Ken Kesey would have loved to arm wrestle her for the title, but I think he'd lose. Ursula was not only a brilliant and prolific author, but an activist for the environment and equal rights, and a humanitarian, loved by pretty much everyone in the Portland, Pacific Northwest, and international literary community, with the possible exception of Jeff Bezos. To honor Ursula, we'll be focusing on the new book, Dispatches from Anaris, Tales in Tribute to Ursula K. Le Guin from Portland's Forest Avenue Press, with our guests Susan DeFreitas, the book's editor, and David Naiman, who wrote the foreword. Susan is an author, editor, and book coach dedicated to telling stories that matter and helping others do the same. Her novel Hot Season won a Gold Ippy Award for Best Fiction of the Mountain West. The Oregonian named Susan one of 25 Oregon authors every Oregonian must read, alongside writers like Cheryl Strayed, Chuck Palahniuk, Willie Vlaughton, and of course, Ursula herself. Susan's work has appeared in the Writer's Chronicle, the Huffington Post, the Utney Reader, Story Magazine, Daily Science Fiction, and Portland Monthly, among others, and she was also a contributor to the Portland-centric story anthology, City of Weird. David Naiman hosts the popular literary podcast Between the Covers, which The Guardian named one of the best book podcasts and most recently listed as one of 5 podcasts that will teach you how to write. He co-authored the book Ursula K. Le Guin, Conversations on Writing from Portland's Tin House Books, which collects material from his interviews with Ursula over the years. David was a KABU radio colleague of mine and taught me just about everything I know about doing book interviews, but please don't hold that against him. In the words of another wonderful Portland-based writer, Kimberly Kim Parsons, Dispatches from Inaris is what happens when a bunch of brilliant writers come together to pay tribute to a singular literary giant. This polyphony of voices from real and imagined worlds is timely, audacious, and teeming with style. Please join us now for our conversation with Susan and David, which is already in progress. Susan and David, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Now, Dispatches from Inaris is a tribute to Ursula Le Guin. I'd like to start by asking you both about Ursula herself and her influence on you. First, you, Susan. In the book's introduction, you write of how important she became to you when you first moved to Portland, both through her books and through the landscapes of the Pacific Northwest that you shared with her, Harney County, the Wallowa Mountains, the Steens Mountain. In your recent Powell's book launch, you said this connection might have begun even earlier, back in your mother's womb.
That's pretty early, isn't it?
Yeah, yes.
one of the things I've shared elsewhere is that I first encountered the Earthsea books in my parents' home library. And, you know, you may be familiar, if you're of a certain age, with these sort of book of the month clubs that used to exist, you know, in the 80s. And they had them for albums as well as books. You know, when you joined the club, you could pick out 20 fantastic titles for a penny a piece. And then the only hook was that they would send you a new title each month. And you, if you didn't want to pay the full price for it, you had to send the book or album back. Well, my parents had joined the fantasy and science fiction book club this way. And there were many, many titles that they either loved and wanted to keep or simply didn't have the time and space to remember to send them back. And so I grew up with a whole shelf of fantastic science fiction and fantasy. And I was very struck by A Wizard of Earthsea, reading it as a tween, as many young people are, because it's the story, you know, the story of Ged in the first book is the story of this brilliant young person who has to overcome his own arrogance and confront his shadow. And it's a story that's tailor-made, I think, for a precociously, you know, smart young person who's reading above their grade level, you know, and reading this book maybe at 11 or 12. And I love the books that followed as well, but there were so many fantastic books on that bookshelf. There was Patricia MacKillop, and there was C.J. Cherry, and there was Stanislaw Lem, and Ray Bradbury, and Stephen R. Donaldson, and the list goes on and on, right? So I understood that Le Guin was a fantastic writer, but I didn't quite understand the full range of her work until I moved to Portland in 2009. And, you know, she has had a larger than life sort of legendary presence about town. And later I would hear the founder of Fish Trap, a literary organization in Eastern Oregon, call her quite simply the intellectual leader of our state. And you could feel that there. And so I thought, well, now is the time to acquaint myself with more of her work. And I was just blown away by the range between her science fiction set in the Haynish universe, all her various fantasy novels, and the sheer quality and emotional power consistently across these books. And so I absolutely fell in love with her work. She became my favorite writer. But it was only later when I talked with my mother that I found out that she had actually been reading those Earthsea books when she was pregnant with me. So in a way you could say Le Guin has been with me my whole life.
That's a great story. Now, David, you interviewed Ursula several times for Between the Covers and collected some of that material in the 2018 book, Ursula K. Le Guin, Conversations on Writing. It seems there was a mutual connection right from the start. She wrote in that book's introduction, "The good interview is like a bad mitten rally. You know, right away, the two of you can keep that birdie in the air and all you have to do is watch it fly." What was it like talking with her and working with her on the Conversations book?
Well, it's interesting that I guess like Susan, my first exposure was Earthsea, but almost all my interactions with Ursula for the show were about things that were marginal to her reputation in the world. they weren't marginal to her, but they weren't the most known aspects of her. And some of the things were actually pretty unknown. So our focus on her poetry and her translations, on her essay writing and literary criticism. And then on our first conversation with talking about craft of writing, grammar, syntax, discovering moral and political questions on the level of the sentence. And I think the reason why we hit it off from the beginning is I think there was both for her an excitement and a relief that I wasn't asking her to pontificate on the status of the future of science fiction, but instead we were grappling over pronouns and sentence length, talking about the difference between telling a story and writing a poem. And what was really fascinating about it was that even when we were staying at that level, I felt like it really exposed a lot of the origins of what we so love about her in the books that she's most well known for. So there was this holographic sort of microcosm, macrocosm relationship that I think happened. And I also, just to add on to something that Susan said about her larger than life presence in the world, that I think speaks to Susan's ingenious notion of collecting writings by writers in Portland under the premise that perhaps writers who share her town or her bioregion are both influenced by her and may have influenced her, and that bringing them together collectively might speak to something about Ursula, not just about them, is that I think she, a lot of what she did in the world wasn't larger than life, or a lot of the important stuff that she was doing wasn't larger than life in the sense that it was quite quiet and she was building ecosystems. So her support of the community radio station, not the most prominent radio station in Oregon, but aligning with her ethos and her politics, or her work at Fish Trap, or her teaching at the Malheur Field Station, or her being one of the founders of the prototype for literary arts. She was doing all of this pretty quietly, supporting and seeding very small micro presses, anarchist and feminist presses that were outside of New York City. These are things she wasn't super well known for. But I think just like the grammar and just like the poetry and just like the translations, I think this was the material from which grew these larger works and her larger than life reputation, even though it was not really spoken about.
I think you call that an imaginative composting of taking all these experiences and kind of working it into her fiction.
Well, that's what she mentioned, this notion from Gary Snyder, which I mentioned in the foreword, of all these ways that you're exposed to things and how you have to have patience and allow them to compost and become soil. Yeah, so I mean, really, the what I wanted to do with the foreword for the book was, because it felt so obvious to me, this this clever connection of gathering writers in Portland and what could they say about Ursula, is I wanted to step back three or four steps and be skeptical of the connection and then work my way back to it. So is this real? Can Portland writers really speak to what Ursula did and what her influence is? And is Portland really that important to, or is the West Coast that important to Ursula's writing when so much of it is taking place in other imagined places?
And that, as you mentioned in the foreword, is the premise behind the book is this influence on Northwest writers and probably Northwest readers. Now, Susan, in your introduction to the book, you quote Ursula's essay, Disappearing Grandmothers, and that's on the ways in which women writers are erased from the literary canon. You mentioned C.J. Cherry. She's a good example. I think Grace Paley is another very good example. Why isn't she up there with Saul Bellows and Philip Ross of the world? Here's the quote. Denigration, omission, and exception during a writer's lifetime are preparations for her disappearance after her death. And you write that Dispatches from Inaris is a further argument to help assure Ursula's place in the canon. Quoting you, one way of insisting upon, one way of saying, look at the world she left us. That seems to be one of your prime objectives with the book, too.
Absolutely. I took those words, which I first heard her speak on in conversation with David Naiman on in the course of a interview. I was walking around I was walking around in Eastern Oregon, yeah, during part of my time with Fish Trap, you know. I heard those words and they raised the hair on the back of my neck, you know. In the wake of her recent death, I took it as a challenge. I took those words as a strong reminder from one of my elders about one of the truths of the world, from a feminist elder, reminding me of one of the truths of the world that, of course, I would just as soon, so many of us would just as soon forget that that is true. But no matter what the progress is that we've made, that we can celebrate, that we can feel good about, that process of erasure of women's intellectual achievements and history is ongoing. It is insidious. It is systemic, right? And in order to keep that from happening, it's not enough just to have an ideal of wanting it not to happen. It's like being anti-racist. You must do something. You must actively pit yourself against this erasure. And to me, this was the hill I was going to die on, really. You know, this is my favorite writer. I thought at some point, you know, when she passed, that maybe I would go back to school and do a PhD just so I could add one academic brick to the wall, holding back the flood that would come, I knew, to try to wash her legacy away. You know, but then there came a moment of truth with myself where I was like, Susan, you hate academia. Why would you do that? Like I chose creative writing rather than, you know, literature for my master's degree, for my undergraduate degree. Like, you know, I can do academia, but I hate it the whole time. You know, I'm a creative writer, but I am also an editor, and I have been an editor for close to 15 years now. And it's one way of blending my creative vision, you know, that I have as a writer, as a creative writer myself, with this act of literary citizenship that I knew I wanted to make on behalf of the great lady. And then also supporting these other voices, you know, in a sort of curation. And I'm also a child of the 80s and 90s, and we used to make these artifacts, boys and girls, called mixtapes. And I was an obsessive mixtape maker. You know, I'd replay the transition from one song to the next over and over until the beat was just exactly right, until there was a tonal, you know, correspondence where there was like something in the lyrics that echoed or counterpointed each other. And that's exactly what I did with this anthology. And it was one of the great joys of my life to create this document.
And I think it actually will turn out to be a bigger brick in that wall than a PhD thesis.
I certainly hope so.
Much wider audience. You're listening to Jonesy on KBOO Portland, your community radio station. On today's show, we're celebrating the life of author, artist, and book coach Susan DeFreitas, who passed away 2 weeks ago at the age of 47. We're re-airing our conversation with Susan from December 2021 on the story anthology she edited, Dispatches from Inaris, Tales in Tribute to Ursula K. Le Guin from Portland's Forest Avenue Press. We were joined by David Naiman, who wrote the book's foreword. Before we get back to our conversation, just a reminder that KBOO is in the middle of our annual All Thrills, No Frills special programming campaign, going on now through April 15th. You can check out our full list of specials and marathons at kboo.fm/ATNF4. I wanted to, of course, focus on Ursula here, but the book itself, I think 31 stories, just incredible stories. One of my favorites in the book, and this is the only exception I'll make about talking about an individual story in the conversation, because it not only was what you called world-class speculative fiction, But it also is very relevant right now with what's happening in the Supreme Court with the possibility of overturning Roe v. Wade, certainly making it much more difficult for women to get abortions. The story's called The Night Bazaar of Women Becoming Reptiles by Rachel K. Jones, no relation. In the introduction, you write that this story touches on gender oppression and a woman's right to choose. And it does it in such a beautiful and powerful way and such an imaginative way that I think Ursula would love it. Fantasy getting to the truth here. I wondered if you could talk, Susan, a little bit about that story, maybe in the light of this quote from Ursula. Who teaches us to be human, what to fear, what to love? Children learn genderless lessons from women, gendered from men. Fathers teach children sex roles, how to be manly and womanlike. Social and moral change comes from women teaching their children to adapt. And this story is definitely one of adaptation. Spoiler alert.
Yeah, I mean, it's such a powerful story. And the thing that struck me as very Le Guinian about it is that the norms around gender, sex, love, and reproduction in the world of Rachel's story are utterly and completely different from our own. It is assumed that, yeah, a woman will have a nightside lover and a sunside lover. And, you know, a family with, I believe, both of them. And, you know, this is what a family is. This is the equivalent of children need both parents. You have to have all four of these five in every family, right? And of course, you must have both a lover of your own gender and of the opposite gender. Like, it would be unthinkable to have anything else, right? And of course, your two lives shall remain separate and never shall they meet. But the protagonist of this story doesn't want a family. She doesn't want all that. She wants outside of the city itself. And there's this magical conceit in this story that if you eat the eggs of a reptile, you know, you will be transformed into a reptile yourself. And that is the only way that you can leave the city, which is an oasis in a burning desert. And there's so many parallels to so many, you know, elements of identity, you know, gender identity, finding an identity outside of the rigid dictates of gender within the city. Deciding whether, as a woman, not wanting to have children and how that's viewed in our society. There are all these ways that the norm is like the only oasis in a burning desert. And if you have the temerity to leave it, you are putting yourself in grave danger. But there is a transformation. There is a possible transformation that can allow you to take on a different identity, a different body even. You know, so hopefully, just as I'm spinning a little bit of this tale for your listeners, they can see all the layers of metaphor, you know, around very complex issues of gender identity and sexual orientation and reproductive rights, all stacking up in this astounding way that they can in great speculative fiction in such a concise and elegant way.
I also wanted to add something to what Susan just said so well, is that there's another element to this story that I think speaks both to other stories in the collection, but also to concerns of Ursula's at large. So this notion that you can eat an egg and then become, if you're a woman and you eat a reptile's egg, you can become a reptile and potentially escape the normative oasis. It's this troubling of, it's not just escaping norms of gender, it's also escaping norms of species. And one of her favorite books was Sword in the Stone. And in that book, the way Merlin trains Arthur to become a king is by transforming him into a rock, into an owl, into all these things. Like, how can he learn to become his destiny? And in a paradoxical way, it's by inhabiting the position of otherness. and in this case, the otherness of other non-human creatures. And so when the protagonist in this story is talking to one of her lovers and saying, I eat these eggs and nothing happens for me, where it's happening seemingly for everybody else, she says, you cannot become what you already are. And to me, that sort of feels like that's speaking to something that I think Ursula is also saying. I mean, in a sense, the ways in which we do have fellow feeling that we try to suppress or deny with creatures across the species divide, for instance. And there are other stories in this collection that also deal with non-human animal, well, not just animal, but non-human intelligence in a way that reflects back on the human.
Oh, it's just a brilliant job of world building. I mean, a lot of the stories in the book are, but this one just struck me in particular, and maybe Rachel K. Jones was channeling Ursula when she was writing the story. Now, back to the abortion part of it, Ursula herself had an abortion when she was a college student at Radcliffe. I think that was the late 40s, early 50s. She writes about this in her essay, What It Was Like, and David, you actually discussed this with her in your conversations book in the nonfiction section. So I'd like to close with an excerpt from a speech she gave to NARAL, that's the National Abortion Rights Action League. I think the speech was in 2012 when she was asked what it was like before Roe v. Wade, and she gives this very personal opinion. Susan, would you read that for us? I think it's just a good way to close, and you're the person to do it.
Absolutely. And, you know, just before I do, I just want to add real briefly, this is a woman of genius, the author of some 68 works of fiction of what I consider to be towering genius. She had this abortion before she'd written a single one of them. Now imagine what might have been taken from her and taken from us had she not been allowed to have that abortion. What was it like in the dark ages when abortion was a crime? For the girl whose dad couldn't borrow cash as my dad could? What was it like for the girl who couldn't even tell her dad because he would go crazy with shame and rage? Who couldn't tell her mother? Who had to go alone to that filthy room and put herself, body and soul, into the hands of a professional criminal? Because that is what every doctor who did an abortion was, whether he was an extortionist or an idealist. You know what it was like for her. You and I know that is why we are here. We are not going back to the dark ages. We are not going to let anybody in this country have that kind of power over any girl or woman. There are great powers outside the government and in it trying to legislate the return of darkness. We are not great powers, but we are the light. Nobody can put us out. May all of you shine very bright and steady today and always.
Susan, thank you. Thank you, David, and thank you, Ursula.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ken.
Well, that's all for this episode of Jonesy here on KABU Community Radio. If you missed any part of the show, would like to hear the longer, unexpurgated version, the director's cut, you might call it, if we had a director, you could listen anytime, on demand, at kboo.fm/program/Jonesy, J-O-N-E-S-Y, or just search for it on the KABU website. Before we head out the door, a big thank you to our guests today, Susan DeFreitas, editor of the new book Dispatches from the Norris, Tales in Tribute to Ursula K. Le Guin from Portland's Forest Avenue Press, and David Naiman, who wrote the book's foreword and co-authored the book Ursula K. Le Guin, Conversations on Writing from Portland's Tin House Books. I'm your host, Ken Jones, no relation, saying, we are not great powers, but we are the light. Nobody can put us out. May all of you shine very bright and steady today and always. Ursula K. Le Guin, 1929 to 2018.